Good morning. Pleasure to have with us here today Mark Rash. Mark is a former federal cybercrime prosecutor. He's now an independent security and
legal consultant.
And legal consultant. We'll just leave it at that. Maybe you can explain
what he does. My wife doesn't even know what I do.
Great. Thanks a lot for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Harry. Well, I think it's afternoon, so I'll say good afternoon. No, it's still morning, right? It's 11 o'clock. Good morning. I'm a lawyer. I'm here to help. I was the head of the U.S. Justice Department's Computer Crime Unit from 1984 till about 1992. But before you get impressed by that fact, you should know that when I left the Justice Department, the Computer Crime Unit consisted of me. And what I'm going to be talking about today is two completely, well, separate but related things. One, I'm going to be talking about cybercrime and how we define it and the relationship between law and technology. And it's not as easy a fit as you might think. And the second thing I'm going to talk about is in broad general strokes about privacy. And when I say I'm going to talk about it, I don't mean that I'm going to talk about it. I mean we're going to talk about it. Because this is going to be an iterative process. So we're going to present a bunch of different problems, different scenarios, and we're going to come up with some solutions, and we're going to solve the problems of the world. Okay? So we've only got, about an hour to do that? We can do that. You need this higher? Or no? All right. Great. All right. So let's start out with the problem of cybercrime. And, of course, I reserve the right to call on people in class, so I hope you did the readings, of which there were none. Okay? Cybercrime. What is cybercrime? Yeah.
Identity.
What is identity theft? We can do this all day. What do you mean by identity theft? Let me give you an example. Let's assume that I get your user ID and your password, and I log into your account using your user ID and password. Have I committed a crime? And you said,
yeah.
What crime?
Impersonating.
Am I? Is a user ID and password an authentication, a token where I'm representing myself to be you, or is it just a key? Am I entering a place that I'm not allowed to be in, or am I pretending to be in? The law treats these differently. One is trespass. One is identity fraud. Which one is it? There's no right answer here. You know, I used to teach a class at George Washington University called Law for Engineers. All right? And the great thing about this is engineers think that there are answers. There's a great story about the CEO of a company who's retiring. And he says to the head of HR, he says, send me the three smartest people in the company. So I send it a scientist, an engineer, and a lawyer. And he says to the scientist, he says, I got one question for you. How much is 2 and 2? And the scientist says, well, it depends on what base you're in and a number of other factors, but generally 2 and 2 is 4. Has him leave. He calls in the engineer. He says, how much is 2 and 2? And the engineer says, 4. Definitely 4. He has him leave. And he calls in the lawyer, and he says, how much is 2 and 2? And the lawyer closes the door, closes the drapes, takes the phone off the hook. He says, what do you want it to be? The problem is that law is developed over time to deal with circumstances. And one of the recurring themes we're going to talk about first, when we talk about the application of law and technology, is that law deals with precedent and by analogies. And we try to figure out, when we take old laws and new technology, what is this like? So the first question we ask is, when I get your user ID and password and log in to a computer, what is that like? Is cyberspace a space? Is it trespass? So you said it was trespass. I get your user ID and your password and I commit the crime of trespass. What is trespass? What's the crime of trespass?
Walking into someone's property.
Well, I walk in people's property all the time. Let me give you an example, because I can do this all day. You're out in the parking lot, and there's a car in the parking lot with the keys in it. Are you allowed to go in the car? It's unlocked. The keys are in it. May you go in the car? Now, not all the same hands. What do you think? Yes, no, maybe, or I don't know.
I'd say probably no.
Okay. How many people agree? So an unlocked door is not an invitation, right? Did I mention there was a baby in the car? Now I did. Now may you go in that car. Well, it's a hot day and the doors are closed, the windows are up. So the answer to that question then is it depends. It depends on the circumstances of why I'm going in, right? Is that trespass?
That's yes. My question.
That's my question. Is that trespass? Yes?
Well, I was going to say, it's if the baby's in trouble, it's not, because you also have like things such as the Good Samaritan law, which will protect you. Right?
No, the Good Samaritan law protects me from negligence liability if I am treating somebody on the street.
But it doesn't
authorize trespass.
Well, no, but I mean, like, what it does, like, it obligates you to, like, to help.
No. Like, nope. Nope. You're standing on Oxford Street. There's a fire across the street. May you jaywalk to put the fire out? It's Cambridge. It's compulsory. You got a question?
Well, is trespass always a negatively connotated word?
Yeah, there's two forms of trespass in the law. There's the kind of trespass we think of when we think of trespass, which is breaking into or remaining unlawfully in a place or in a building, right? And it goes back from the common law of burglary. Burglary at common law was the breaking and entering into the dwelling of another at nighttime with the intent to commit a felony therein. Now, we've modified that from the common law to breaking into any building with the intent to commit a crime. All right? But it requires the idea that the initial entry be illegal. Trespass doesn't have that requirement. For trespass, let me give you an example. You are walking through the woods. There's a sign that says no trespassing, and you continue on forward. Are you guilty of trespassing? That was an easy one. Yes. Now, same circumstance, same demarcation, but no sign. Guy comes out with a shotgun, says, "You're on my land." At that instant, are you trespassing?
No.
Now you refuse to leave. Are you trespassing?
No.
Ooh, I love the law. So the concept of trespass in the physical environment is hard enough to figure out when you're trespassing, when you're not trespassing. But let me give you another example. This is an actual example. In Ohio, for example, you're allowed to carry a gun, and if you have a permit to carry a gun. If a restaurant wants to prohibit you from carrying a gun, they have to post a sign that says no guns allowed. Now, since you have a gun permit and you're allowed to carry the gun, if they make such a posting and you carry a gun into that place, you are now in there in excess of your authorization. Okay? Which means you are now committing the crime of trespass. That's the crime, trespass. Now, here are some problems applying the concept of trespass to cyberspace. Number one. No walls. No postings, no barriers, no walls, no lines of demarcation. Okay? So, let's just say a guy from the street decides to walk in here, sit over there, and listen to this lecture. Are they trespassing?
There is a sign on the building here.
What does it say?
No trespassing.
Right, but what does that mean? That means you can't be here unless you're authorized. How is someone authorized to be here? Who authorizes it? Who gives permission? Who gives consent? Why are you allowed to be here?
Well, I was going to say I'm enrolled in the university, but if I had brought a friend to lecture, they would probably be allowed in here too, so I'm not, I don't think there's a reason.
Are you enrolled in this class?
Yes.
So anybody who's enrolled in the university can be here, or just people who are enrolled in the class? And what if you didn't pay your tuition? Would you then be trespassing? Check bounces, you go to jail? So one of the problems we have is this whole concept of authorization and permission pervades the concept of trespass. Now I'm going to apply it to the internet. Okay. Does anybody know about the case about Lori Drew? Does this ring a bell to anybody? Except you. Lori Drew was a 49-year-old woman who lived in rural Missouri. She had a 13-year-old daughter. Her 13-year-old daughter had a MySpace account and a 13-year-old friend. The two 13-year-old girls communicated back and forth on MySpace and were friendly, if not friends. Okay? Lori Drew was friendly with the other girl. They had gone on a trip together, so they knew each other. For some reason, there was a falling out between the two girls. So the mother of the 13-year-old, Lori Drew, wanted to find out what was going on with this other girl. So the mother created a MySpace account in the name, in the fictitious name of this kid named Josh, who pretended to be a 19-year-old boy and put a photograph of a 19-year-old boy on the MySpace account and friended the other 13-year-old girl. And continued to have a relationship, a virtual relationship with that 13-year-old girl for a few weeks. At the end of this relationship, she terminated the relationship saying, "The world would be better off without you," as the 19-year-old boy. The 13-year-old girl went in her closet and hung herself. Question: did Lori Drew commit a crime? And if so, what crime? You're the prosecutor in Missouri. You want to prosecute this person. What they did was reprehensible. What are we going to prosecute her for? Make something up, because that's what we do.
Right. I don't know if you could say involuntary manslaughter, but
Did she intend that the girl commit suicide?
No.
Okay. So that one's out. Did she actively encourage the girl to commit suicide?
Maybe more of a general harassment.
Let me ask you this question. Let's assume that Josh was a real person. He was a real 19-year-old boy and said exactly the same thing to her, and she killed herself. Could Josh be prosecuted? Anybody want to jump in here? Yeah.
Well, I think the case was resolved. Like, shoot.
Forget how the case was resolved. Ignore how the case was resolved. These aren't the droids you're looking for.
Well, then, no. Like if the Josh was a real person, I don't think he could be prosecuted.
Okay. How many people think Josh could be prosecuted? For what?
I just think that there must be. They could have at least. There could be something that could be tried. I don't know if it would have been an effective...
We want to prosecute this woman. We want her to go to jail. So let's find something to prosecute her for.
Wrongful impersonation and intent to deceive.
All right. So that she... False personation of a 19-year-old boy. So what you're now creating is a precedent that says if you create an account in a name other than your own or falsely... Now, this guy Josh is not a real person, okay? So what you're saying is lying on the internet about who you are should be a crime.
No.
Yes, they do. The average person commits about 5 felonies a week. The only thing that saves you from committing more is that you can't spend all day online, okay? So, what crime are we going to prosecute Lori Drew for? Let's go back to the original question, which was, if this had been a real Josh and they were just mean to somebody online, and that meanness had consequences, could they be prosecuted? Let's say reckless indifference, reckless disregard.
She might have liked Josh.
Josh might have been intended. Well, the mother definitely did.
You don't know what she intended.
No, I thought it was she wanted to get back at the daughter's friend.
No, she wanted to find out stuff.
The world would be better off without. That's harmful in itself. I mean.
Well, okay. There is a tort called the intentional infliction of severe emotional distress. Okay. But it's not a crime. It's a tort, meaning a civil wrong like defamation or negligence. It's not a crime. But can we make it a crime? Those of you with internet connection, take a look at Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 1030, 18 U.S.C. 1030. Just Google it, and you'll get... the Cornell University webpage, where you'll be able to see the statute. That's the first place you're going to look, is the computer crime statute. And we'll get to that. Gesundheit. So, we'll talk about our analysis of this in a minute, but before we get to that, Josh, could Josh be prosecuted for a crime, if Josh really existed? Anybody say yes? You want to, don't you?
I'm not sure. Well, I don't have an argument yet.
Okay. What Josh did is what everybody does every day online. They're mean to other people. They're not nice. They're inconsiderate. They're rude. They're oafish. They're disrespectful. They're human. Okay? And sometimes that causes people harm and pain, but not. Now, it's not Josh. But it is Lori Drew. What did Lori Drew do that should be prosecuted? Or should she? Yep?
I don't think there are like laws that you can just like prosecute her. Like obviously it's like a law against like humanity, but it's not like...
Right. But you see, this is a political office. Everybody is saying this is really bad. So now let's say there isn't a law. Should there be one? And if so, what should it say?
Well, part of the problem is that no one really knows how MySpace works. So it's such a new thing that you don't know the consequences of your act. Even she didn't know the consequences of her own actions. It would be hard to make a law about MySpace and all future MySpace.
Do we need a separate law for MySpace? Would it have mattered if this was over the phone? Over the telegraph? With smoke signals? Do we need to have a separate law of cyberspace? And every time a new application comes out, a new law for Twitter, a new law for Facebook?
Well, they each work differently.
They do. Do we need a different law for each one? Yeah.
Well, perhaps you could come up with a law that restricts, interaction over like social networking sites or sites like that between adults and children under a certain age.
Let's write one, shall we? All statutes start with the word whoever. Whoever what? Whoever does this goes to jail. Let's finish that sentence. We are Congress. Okay? What are we, the 111th Congress? Right? And if you know your etymology, you know that if pro is the opposite of con, the opposite of progress is therefore Congress, right? So, anybody know the etymology of the word politics? Poly meaning many, and ticks meaning blood-sucking creatures. Okay. So we're writing a statute. Whoever, being an adult, okay? Why do I feel like I'm like in my driveway with a bunch of 8-year-olds. being an adult, meaning over the age of 18, does what? Communicates with a child by whatever network. However we want to define those terms. And?
Like without, or maybe without consent of their legal guardian or parent or something.
So if I want to send an email to somebody under the age of 18, I have to ask their parent if it's okay for me to talk to them?
How about maintains a consistent relationship?
Okay, how are we going to define that term? You know, my high school girlfriend would love to know the answer to that question.
Are we defining a child as under 18?
No, we can define child and adult.
Because if we define child like under like 14, 13, I'd say it's not totally unreasonable to prevent emails. To
all right. Now, do I have to know they're a child?
Yes.
Okay. So if they falsely claim to be over the age of 18, all right, then what happens? So whoever knowingly communicates, whoever being over the age of 18, knowingly communicates with a person under the age of 18 without the consent of that person's parent or legal guardian goes to jail. Okay, I now revise my number of the number of felonies you commit a week to 50,000.
I don't think a child should be like under the age of 18, though. It needs to be like closer to like 13 or 12.
All right, so now if I am the coach of a football team and I'm trying to recruit, okay, we already have a statute called COPPA. Okay? I'm sorry, COPPA. COPPA and COPPA are different statutes. COPPA is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which makes it illegal to collect personally identifiable information about people under the age of 13 without their parents' consent. Sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? So now I have a web page and I'm selling something. And the first thing I ask for is I ask for personal information, right? Before I can do that, what's the first thing I have to ask you? How old are you? What's your date of birth? Well, isn't that personal information? So now, a piece of personal information that I don't really care or have any need or desire to collect, I now have to collect under the law in order to comply with the law. So in order, let's say I have no intention of collecting personal information. I just want to ship them the product, wherever it is. Now, I have to ask that question in order to comply with the law. So I have to collect personal information in order to avoid a law which is designed to protect personal information.
Doesn't collecting imply storing the information?
No. I can discard it. I can just simply say if you put in a date below a date that is, you know, whatever, 13 years ago, that it won't allow you to get on the site. I don't need to collect it. I don't need to store it. But I need to validate it and verify it. Okay? So, let's get back to... So we're not going to do this. We're not going to make it illegal to just communicate with them. What is the crime? What do we want to make illegal? Whoever... Yeah?
I just don't think that there's really a need to create any sort of law around it because I think that the desire to create a law is kind of just a response to this general anxiety and fear about, like, people connecting with the internet and like what exactly the internet is, and I think that it's probably more about education and like learning about how people respond. Like this girl, like could have been severely depressed as it was, and was
she was, but the mother, the woman knew it. Lori Drew knew that the woman had been treated for depression. Should Lori Drew go to jail? That's the first question I got. Raise your hand if you think Lori Drew should go to jail. We got one. How many people think Lori Drew should not go to jail? How many people here, your right arm is paralyzed?
My statement is that Lori Drew should fry in hell.
Okay, fry in hell. Okay. And the question is, why? What did she do that was so morally reprehensible? And why would you say that somebody who does something morally reprehensible, that the law would provide no recourse for it, or should provide no recourse? We can write laws. We've been doing it for thousands of years, at least since Hammurabi. But laws enforce the conscience of the community. So what did she do that was morally reprehensible?
Well,
Start with the thing about computer crime, and this is the takeaway right here. This is the nut. Stop focusing on technology. Stop focusing on the means of communication. Focus on what did they do that makes me sick. Does that make you sick when somebody poses as somebody else? All right, so that's not it. That's not the thing that makes me sick.
Well, I mean, I think the problem is not that she poses as another person, but the reason why she poses in that.
She posed as another person because she wanted to get information about her daughter.
Because she wanted, was it because she wanted to get information about her daughter, or because she wanted to harass somebody?
Because she wanted to get information about her daughter.
Why did she harass her?
Because the woman wouldn't let go. She was posing as a 19-year-old, she created a relationship, and she wanted to break up, and the 13-year-old wouldn't break up. So she did it to break up. She was ending the relationship. Relationships never, never end well, ever. Cyber relationships, real relationships, they don't end well. Are we going to make that a crime?
She could have just stopped replying. That would have been a completely different effect than
she could have.
Go hang yourself.
There are many things we could do when terminating a relationship. That doesn't mean that what we do becomes a felony. All right. So we have to focus first on whether can we prosecute this person. All right? Take a look at 18 USC 1030. Tell me if you can find a crime. Yes. Yeah?
Would it have been different if she had been, like, sending letters as someone else, I'm just trying to think of whether there's any kind of parallel.
In other words, if you take out the cyberspace component.
Yeah, I'm trying to decide whether that, I think that it adds to it in some way, like some kind of social.
The effect is the same. She's pretending to be a person, communicating with that person, having the same communications.
Yeah.
And the result would be the same. Okay. So why should we prosecute them based on the technology? Can we find a crime? I prosecuted a former Harvard student for computer crime, a person by the name of Robert Morris. A good one.
A good student.
Good student, too. And a good person. Right. What's that?
He's currently a professor at MIT.
Fortunately, he had just left Harvard and was at Cornell at the time, so
we've referred to him as a Cornell.
He is referred to as the Cornell hacker, although
he's a professor at MIT.
That's right. Then he's and in fact, during the course of that prosecution, you know, one of the jurors after the conviction came up to me and said, "You know, we convicted him of a crime, but we didn't think he was a criminal." And I said, "I wholeheartedly agree with you." Okay, but. One of the interesting side notes to that is that one of the meetings where he was planning his computer worm.
Does everybody know who he is and what he did?
Robert Morris? All right. Let me go back and give you a little bit of history on this. Robert Tappan Morris I use his middle name because to distinguish him from his father, about whom more in a minute. Robert Morris had just graduated undergrad from Harvard and was then just starting at Cornell University. And he wrote in November of 1988, wrote a computer worm that was designed to break into computers on the internet. This thing called the internet. Anybody heard of it? And it was designed to use about five or six different mechanisms to break into computers. Various vulnerabilities and defects and things like that to break into the computer. And all it was designed to do once it broke in was make a copy of itself, leave a copy on the computer, and then try to break into another computer from there. That's it. Had no destructive payload whatsoever. Wasn't designed to cause harm, wasn't designed to do anything bad. Just break in, make a copy, and then from there break into whatever it was connected to. The problem was, if you were from computer A and broke into computer B, it would look at computer B and say, leave a copy in computer B and say, what else can I break into? And it would break into C, D, E, and back into A again. And the rate of interconnectivity was such that within a few minutes of the infection, almost all computers on the internet were doing nothing more than making copies of the worm.
He would not be famous if he had to have a bug in his program.
Yeah, well, he anticipated that there would be a reinfection rate. So he actually programmed it so that most of the time it would not reinfect the computer that had been already infected. But he wanted it to be persistent. So he said, one out of every 600 times that it tries to infect, if it finds it, do so, infect it. If it finds it, most of the time don't, but one out of every 600 times. That should have been 60,000. It was a bug. Okay? Had that number been correct, it still would have infected all the computers, but it wouldn't have shut them down. But it did, within minutes, including computers at NORAD, including computers at the Air Force, including computers. About 10% of the computers on the internet were shut down by this worm within a matter of about 15 minutes. The damages were estimated at about $96 million. Okay? His father, Robert Morris, we call him Senior, but he's technically not Senior. By the way, the name Robert Morris, you may recognize anybody here, American history buffs, from the Declaration of Independence, okay, which is direct descendant. He's a direct descendant of that Robert Morris. The father was the chief scientist of the National Computer Security Center at the National Security Agency.
Harvard 58.
And in fact, I was working with the father on an investigation of a completely different computer hacker case at the time that this worm hit. It's an interesting story, which I can tell you later, how we found that it was Robert Morris, but we found it fairly quickly. One of the ways we found it is he told his father, and his father told the FBI. So it wasn't exactly like a lot of investigation necessary. But the hard part was what to do. What do we do with them? $96 million worth of damage. A hacker community who was watching the first computer hacker case trying to decide what to do. And we were afraid of two things. Number one, if we prosecuted this guy, that the hacker community would respond by hacking a lot of different computers as outrage. Or if we didn't prosecute, then they'd say, oh great, everything is free and clear, we can do whatever we want. So we decided we would ignore the hacker community and just do what we thought was appropriate. And in this case, what we decided to do was to prosecute him for one count of computer hacking. Instead of 50,000 counts, just one count of computer hacking. But it was a felony. And so it had significant consequences as well. And one of the things as a prosecutor I have to tell you is you always have to be mindful of the consequences of your actions. You should never rush to a prosecution, and you should never over-prosecute a case. And so we never claimed he was a bad guy. We never claimed he was evil. He was clearly about 15 times smarter than I was, which made for an interesting cross-examination because he testified at the trial. And he said, I did it, and I'm sorry. And I turned to my co-counsel, and she said, you want to cross-examine him? And I said, do you want me to prove he didn't do it or that he's not sorry? So it made for an interesting prosecution. Now, the interesting thing about it, unfortunately for Robert Morris, was that the day he released the worm was November 2nd, 1988. And the federal sentencing guidelines for computer crime went into effect November 2nd, 1988. Had he released the worm the day before, the federal sentencing guidelines would not have applied. But he released them that day, which was unfortunate because it gave a mandatory sentence of about a year and a half for what he did. Even when we picked the absolute lowest number we could, we had estimates of damages anywhere up to $96 million. I told the judge that the damage was $250,000, which was the absolute lowest number I could come up with. And still would have been about a year and a half in jail. And I didn't believe that Robert Morris needed to do a year and a half in jail. So the judge gave him probation for no particular reason, by the way. Completely illegal sentence. He just said, I find that the sentencing guidelines don't apply and I give him probation. And so I called the Justice Department, my superiors there, and they said, we need to appeal. And I said, well, we got two problems if we appeal. Number one, we could lose. Number two, we could win. I don't want to win. This way we get to grumble and complain about the sentence, but not actually have to do anything about it, which worked out pretty well. So that was the Robert Morris prosecution. Okay. So it was a very interesting. Yes?
I actually just have a question about the Laurie Drew
case. About which?
The Laurie Drew case.
Okay, Laurie Drew.
Okay, so in Missouri, there's like a state law against harassment.
Right.
Which covers electronic communication.
Right.
Couldn't she be tried under that?
There was no harassment.
Well, how they define harassment is, all right, so one of the ways of defining harassment is knowingly communicates with another person who is or who purports to be 17 years of age or younger, and in doing so, and without good cause, recklessly frightens, intimidates, or causes emotional distress.
Okay, take a look at the date of that statute.
August 28th, 2008.
So why do you think that statute was passed?
Okay, so they passed it.
Okay. No ex post facto laws. Okay. That's the Laurie Drew statute. That statute does not exist yet. So, what do we prosecute her for? Now, this goes back to our discussion of trespass. Okay? Did Laurie Drew commit the crime of trespass? What is electronic trespass?
Oh, it's like a wolf or like a sheep back then, because she was allowed to communicate with the girl because the girl thought she was a girl.
But that's not trespass.
Authorization?
Well, the first question is, if she committed trespass, to what computers did she trespass? Can you trespass on a computer?
I don't think so, but the only argument I can think of is that if she trespassed into her abstract network of comfort or friends or trespass. I mean, whether there was a boundary that she crossed, but I don't think it's a physical boundary, so I'm not sure if it could be considered trespass unless there's a kind of electronic trespass.
Do you have the statute in front of you?
Yes.
18 U.S.C. 1030. Do you have it in front of you? Because I need to. All right, here we go. All right, take a look at I think it should be A4A. No, I'll get it for you. You can see how well these things are written. I'll have to find the exact provision, but whoever intentionally accesses a computer without authorization, okay, guilty of trespass. You agree with that? If I access a computer without authorization, guilty of a crime, trespass.
But is access our own computer?
Let's start with that concept. We're going to extend it a little bit. Whoever accesses a computer without authorization is guilty of the crime of trespass. Does everybody agree that that should be the law? No, it doesn't. That's a jurisdictional requirement because it's a federal statute. So you have to show some federal nexus. Interstate commerce, federal computer, whatever else it is. Okay. Whoever accesses a computer without authorization is guilty of a crime. Should that be the law? We're Congress. We can write anything we want. Subject to the Constitution. Should that be the law? Yes, no, or maybe.
Well, I feel like it's sort of problematic in the idea of accessing a computer.
What does access mean? What does it mean to access a computer?
someone I trust.
And you have a you have a policy saying no password sharing. So you've given them your password. They log in at your direction, but in violation of the policy. Well, you violated the policy. Have they accessed the computer without authorization?
No.
No.
Well,
what
if they did something else on the computer that you didn't
have? Wow, but you had to look at the access first. Okay, is the access without authorization? Let's go back to a more fundamental question. What the heck is a computer? Sure, these things are computers, right? Is, hold up your left hand, Is that a computer? Her watch, is it a computer? Yeah. Clearly this phone that's been ringing on and off is a computer as well. So if we define the word computer broadly to include my microwave oven, and define the word access to mean use. If somebody bakes a potato in my microwave oven, they are guilty of computer crime. I love the law. All right? But wait, it gets worse. Because it's not just a crime to access without authorization. It is also a crime to exceed the scope of your authorization to access. Which may mean that if I obtain authorization to access the computer by fraud, deception, then I am committing the crime of trespass, which is the theory under which they prosecuted Lori Drew. That when Lori Drew set up the MySpace account in the name of Josh, she accessed the computer. Whose computer? Whose computers did she access?
MySpace.
MySpace's computers located where? Anybody know?
MySpace headquarters.
Beverly Hills, California. So she accessed the computers in Beverly Hills, California in excess of her authorization to do so. Now, how do we know what she's authorized to do on the MySpace computers? Terms of use. So, now what we're saying is, violating terms of use is a crime. If you violate the terms of use, but she says, I never read them. Is that a defense?
Yes.
I love the law. Is that a defense? I never read them. The statute says whoever knowingly exceeds the scope of authorization to access a computer. Is it a defense to say, I never read them? By the way, you're required to click I agree. How many people here read the terms of use before you agree? Do you now?
Yeah.
All right. Do you have an eBay account?
No.
Do you have an Amazon account?
No.
Do you have a computer? Cool. Do you have an account here at Harvard? All right, we're going to step back and ask yourself a very simple question. Mm-hmm. May Harvard University read your email? It's in the terms of use that you said you read.
I'm sure it is. I'm also sure I can't remember a word from the terms of use.
There you go. Well, reading it and not remembering it is the same thing as not having read it. By the way, did you have any ability to negotiate that one?
I'm sure not.
Okay. Compelled consent. I love it. We'll get back to that in a second when we talk about privacy. How are we doing on time, by the way?
We got about 8 minutes.
8 minutes, okay. All right. So I'm just going to step back here for a minute and tell you about the Lori Drew, the end verdict. All right? It was the worst of all possible verdicts because the way they charged her with, the trespass statute I just told you is exceeding the scope of authorization, and it's a misdemeanor. So they basically said by creating the account in this person's name, she was violating the terms of use and therefore committing the misdemeanor crime of trespass. But they went further and says, if you access a computer without authorization or in excess of your authorization with the intent to commit a crime or tort, that's a felony. So they prosecuted her for the felony. And their theory was she created the MySpace account in the name of Josh with the intent to commit the tort of intentional infliction of severe emotional distress. Remember I said earlier, let's look at the thing that we think is bad, the bad conduct, and try to prosecute her for that? And that's what they were trying to do. The bad conduct was the intentional infliction of emotional distress, not the creation of the fictitious account. All right? So they prosecuted her for exceeding her scope of authorization with the intent to commit severe emotional distress. Now, here's the problem. The jury didn't believe it. The jury did not believe that she intended to inflict emotional distress. In fact, the jury wasn't even convinced that she's the one who sent that message. She had a 19-year-old girl working at the flower shop where she worked. The 19-year-old is the one who told her how to set up the account. She was 49 years old. She doesn't know from MySpace and Facebook. She doesn't know how to do this stuff. The 19-year-old set it up for her. The jury did not believe that she did this. But they convicted her of the misdemeanor, which is the exceeding the scope of authorization. The problem with that, they also said that they did not know whether or not she had actually read the terms of use. So what we now have the state of the law is if you violate the terms of use of any website, you're guilty of a crime. That's the way the state of the law is right now. Let me give you another example. This is deals with online contract, and then we'll talk about privacy. You put up a web page, publicly accessible. You have a home page, and behind it you got a bunch of other pages. And the home page says, this is my publicly accessible web page. This is copyrighted. I own the copyright to all the content. By proceeding beyond this web page, you're agreeing to the following. One, you agree not to, other than a cash copy of it, incidental to reading, not to copy any of these pages. You agree that if you violate that agreement, you will pay me $5,000 per page that you copy. That every time you copy it, you owe me $5,000. That I will be able to sue you in California. You consent to jurisdiction and venue in California, and that I don't have to prove actual damages. And I have that on my main page. Without a click, I agree. Now, does the mere fact that I don't have a click, I agree, mean that the agreement isn't binding? Is that a contract? Let us assume you go to that web page, you read that web page, and you decide to proceed beyond the home page and look at the other pages. And you now deliberately copy one of those pages. Are you liable to me for $5,000? What's that? Right. You went past it. You agreed to the terms and service, or the terms of use. You owe me $5,000. Right? Anybody disagree? Okay. You? Why? It may be. The court may determine not to enforce it, but it's my copyright. I can put whatever conditions I want on your access to my copyrighted work. Who's to say what the value of that thing is? Copyright entitles me to $10,000 of statutory damages. Okay? Right. Because I'm just that kind of guy. All right? Now, anybody hear of the Wayback Machine? The Internet Archive constantly goes around and makes archive. You ever go to Google and it says cached? Okay, it caches everything on the web. So every couple of days it makes a copy of this person's web pages. There are 10 pages, $5,000 each, three times a day. She waits, she waits, she waits. Sues the Internet Archive for $1 million in California. Who wins? They say, look, we never read this thing. We just copy everything that's publicly accessible. Who wins that case? How do you enter into a contract online? Everything we do in cyberspace, in e-commerce, depends on the ability to contract online. But how do we do this? So we see how the technology transforms everything.